Let's turn to Acts chapter 18. Remember, Paul is in Corinth in the section of Acts chapter 18 that we've been looking at. And last time we looked at his arrival at Corinth, we looked first at a little background information, and we'll just review this slightly so we can pick up this evening. The culture of Corinth, remember, we described it in two words. And the first word was cosmopolitan. What cosmopolitan means is simply that there were people from a wide divergence of backgrounds and cultures there. And the reason we noted was there were two reasons we noted. One was because of its strategic location. Here's Corinth right there, if you can see it on the map. And you'll see how strategically it's located between the Aegean and the Adriatic Seas so that shippers could bring their boats down to Corinth, unload them, pack them 5 miles across that little isthmus there, and load them up again and head on out. So it was very strategic location, east-west-wise. It was cheaper for them to take their ships that 5 miles than it was to sail around 200 miles clear down to the south of Greece. And the seas there are very windy and stormy. So it was very well located for east-west travel. Also for north-south. Look, if you were going from southern Greece up to northern Greece, that's about it, unless you want to take a ship. So very well situated, and that's one reason it was cosmopolitan. People from all over the world came there. Remember, it was very well protected. It had a good protection and fort, and it was very important politically. It was the home, remember, of the Roman proconsul, and the Roman proconsul would be the governor of the entire province of southern Greece. It was called Achaia. And so it was very important politically. And we'll see Paul will meet the proconsul tonight in this evening's lesson. So for those two reasons, it was a very cosmopolitan city. It was also a very corrupt city. And in fact, it was the most corrupt city in the entire Roman Empire. In fact, we looked at the word Corinthiazomai last week. That means to practice fornication. That's what the word meant, because it was so common in Corinth that when someone was practicing fornication, they just said, well, you're acting like a Corinthian, or it's a Corinthiazomai was the word. It was the home of the temple of Aphrodite, remember? That's the temple that had the 1,000 temple prostitutes. So very, very corrupt city. Cosmopolitan and corrupt. And here comes Paul with the gospel. Now, his arrival at Corinth is described in Acts chapter 18, verse 1 through 4. And notice he immediately makes friends with a couple of Jewish folks there that came down from Rome. In verse 1 of chapter 18, it says, after these things, he left Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. So these guys came on down from Rome because Claudius had issued a decree stating that all the Jews had to leave Rome. And then as Paul gets down there, verse 4, he follows his usual custom of reasoning in the synagogue. Verse 4 says, and he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. So he takes his usual course of action, his usual practice, and in verse 5 through 11, we get a little information about his stay down in Corinth. And the first thing we noted that he got good news from Thessalonica when Timothy met him there, Silas and Timothy, verse 5 says, but when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word. And we said two things about that. First, we looked at 1 Thessalonians 3. Look at 1 Thess 3, and we'll see where the good news came from. And if you were here last week, you can This is just a little review. In verse 6 through 10 of chapter 3, Paul says, but now that Timothy has come to us from you, remember Thessalonica was in northern Greece or Macedonia, and they came down to meet Paul, and they caught up with him in Corinth. And Paul says, but now that Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us good news of your faith and love, and that you always think kindly of us, longing to see us just as we also long to see you. So Paul got good news from Silas and Timothy. And then we also noted in Acts chapter 18:5 that he said that Paul began devoting himself completely to the word. And we noted in Philippians that Paul had received a monetary gift from the Philippians. So that allowed him then to devote himself to God's word entirely. Verse 6 and 7 describe the crisis, the inevitable crisis, I should say, because it happens every time. We see the usual pattern here. Paul goes to a new city. He goes down to the synagogue, starts proclaiming Jesus as the Messiah from the Old Testament. The Jews reject him, so he goes to the Gentiles. He turns to the Gentiles, and we see that same thing here in verse 6 and 7. It says, but when they resisted and blasphemed, he shook out his garments and said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. Then he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God whose house was next to the synagogue. So he goes to the Gentiles. And then in verse 8, it talks about the church there next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his household. And many of the Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and being baptized. So the church there was growing. And then in verse 9 through 11, the encouragement. And remember, Paul needed encouragement because he was in danger. Here he had proclaimed the gospel, and Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, had believed it. So in the Jews' eyes, he was a traitor. And Paul had brought it about, so they were very angry with him. And here was Paul, had his church right next door to the synagogue. So he was in physical danger. And verse 9 through 11, God tells him not to worry. He said, I've got a job for you, and nothing will happen until this job is complete. Verse 9, and the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking, and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city. And he settled there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. Now that brings us up then to where we're going to pick up this evening, and that is Paul before the proconsul Gallio. That'll be in verse 12 through 17. Let's read those verses now. That's the next paragraph up in the section. In verse 12, it says, but while Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat, saying, this man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there are questions about words and names and your own law, look after it yourselves. I am unwilling to be a judge of these matters. And he drove them away from the judgment seat. And they all took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. But Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. Now, the first thing we need to note in this section is about Gallio, the proconsul. He was a prominent Roman official. In fact, Gallio, the proconsul of Achaia, was the most prominent Roman official that Paul had yet stood before. Now, remember, in the other cities where he'd been, well, look at chapter 16, and we'll use Thessalonica for an example. In chapter 16, verse 8 and 9, that's not right, is it? Chapter 17, verse 8 and 9. In chapter 17, verse 8 and 9, it says, they stirred up the crowd and the city authorities who heard these things. And when they had received a pledge from Jason and the others, they released them. Now the city authorities, the politarchs down in Thessalonica, had a limited authority. Their authority was limited to their city. And remember when we looked at this section, we said they took a pledge from Jason, and that pledge was kind of like a bond. And that bond was to guarantee that Paul would not return to Thessalonica. So these guys, the politarchs, were city officials. Well, now he's in front of Gallio, the Roman proconsul. Now, Gallio is not simply a city official. He had jurisdiction over the entire province, the entire Roman province of Achaia, and that would have covered most of southern Greece. So he's a little more important of an official than Paul had come across before, stood before. Now, there's more to it than that. Not only was he a proconsul, but the Roman proconsuls of the various provinces had a habit of when one made a decision on something, the others would follow along with it. They would say, well, this precedent was set. We do it in our own court system. We say, this precedent was set by this person. I'm not going to overturn it. So had Gallio ruled against Paul, most likely the rest of the Roman Empire would have went along with him. So this is a very, very important court appearance for Paul, because this could have been the end of his ministry. I mean, literally. So Paul, we have a significant event here. Paul standing before Gallio. And the charge in verse 13 is the same charge that we've had before the city officials, the same charge that the Jews always trumped up against Paul. It says in verse 13, saying, this man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. Well, the question is, whose law is it contrary to? And they're talking about Roman law, not Jewish law. So here come these Jews. It seems kind of funny. Here comes these Jews, and they say to the Roman proconsul, this guy's practicing a religion that's illegal under Roman law. So that was their charge. Remember, we looked at the terms religio licita and religio illicita. And they claimed that Christianity was a religio illicita. So the Jews, their argument went something like this. First off, they rejected his message about Christ being the Messiah. So they say Christ is not the Messiah. Therefore, they denied that Paul's religion had anything to do with Judaism. They said, Christ isn't the Messiah, therefore Paul, his religion has nothing to do with Judaism. Now remember, Judaism was protected under Roman law. It was a religio licita. It was a valid, protected religion under Roman law. But the Jews then, they reasoned, well, if Paul's Messiah isn't the Messiah of Israel, then Paul's religion is not Judaism, therefore he's not protected under Roman law. So that was their argument. It had nothing to do with Jewish law. They were talking about Roman law, and that's why Paul ended up before the proconsul. They figured that his teaching should be banned by Roman law because it wasn't Judaism. Well, in verse 14 through 16, we get the outcome of this trial. And it's almost kind of funny. Verse 14 says, but when Paul was about to open his mouth, so here comes Paul, he's ready to defend himself. He's just about to defend himself. Gallio doesn't even give him a chance to defend himself. He decides immediately that, as he says, Verse 14, but when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrong or of vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. So he refuses to even hear the case. I mean, they don't even get a chance to present their arguments. He just says, this dispute you guys are having is completely within Judaism. So he, like most people, saw Christianity as being a subset of Judaism. So he said, whether this Messiah is your Messiah or not, that's all between you Jews. It has nothing to do with the Romans. So he doesn't even hear the case. In fact, he says, you know, if it were a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, that sort of a crime, then he would hear the case. But since it's just a matter of nitpicking in your own religion, then he didn't want anything to do with it. Verse 15, it says, but if there are questions about words and names and your own law, look after it yourself. You take care of that yourself. He didn't want anything to do with that. He was a busy man, so to speak. And it had nothing to do with Roman law, so he didn't want anything to do with it. In fact, he rebukes these Jews. And we see that in the word he uses, and you can see it even in English. In verse 14, he says, if it was a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. You see the snub there, the rebuke, the anti-Semitism in action, clear back here. He's saying, I'd have to put up with you people if it was really something that had to do with Roman law. Since it doesn't, go away. He didn't want to have to put up with it. Look at Matthew 17. The same word is used, and you get the idea of what it means. Anektos is the Greek word. It means to endure, to endure. He says, I would have to endure you people if you had an argument that really had anything to do with Roman law. Matthew 17:17, and this is Jesus talking. Verse 17 says, and Jesus answered and said, you unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? So you get the idea of Jesus' frustration. He says, how long am I going to have to put up with this kind of stuff? And 1 Corinthians 4, another example. So it's quite a rebuke that the Roman proconsul is giving to the Jews here. And we'll see that when the people on the street, the ones who were gathered there to listen to this trial, pick up on that little rebuke, they're going to take advantage of it to exercise some anti-Semitism of their own. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 12. Paul is talking. He says, when we toil, working with our own hands, when we are reviled, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure. So you see the very negative connotation of enduring here. It's enduring persecution. So take that back then to Acts chapter 18, and you'll see that Gallio didn't even want to have to put up with these Jews. He said, if it was a real case, I will, but since it isn't, I don't have to put up with you guys, so leave. And that's exactly what he tells them in verse 16, and he drove them away from the judgment seat. He says, get lost, basically. Now, in verse 17, we see a display of anti-Semitism, and that's going to be they're going to pick up on what Gallio said to these Jews and take advantage of it. Now, anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish feelings were very common in the Gentile cities. Remember back in chapter 16, look back at Acts 16. When we were looking at the section about the Pythoness, the girl that was the slave girl that had the spirit of divination, we called her the Pythoness at the time. And in verse 19, it says, but when her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, that is after Paul had cast out her spirit of divination, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the authorities. They seized Paul and Silas. Remember back in chapter 16 in verse 1 to 3, talks about Timothy. In chapter 16, verse 1, it says, Paul came also to Derbe and Lystra, and a disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek. Now, Paul picks up Timothy and takes him along with him. And then down at verse 10, it says, when he had seen the vision, that is the man of Macedonia, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia. Who's the we there? Remember when we noted this was one of the we sections of the book of Acts and that Luke had written the book of Acts, therefore Luke was with him because it says we went. So you have Paul, Silas, Timothy, and Luke. Well, if you go over to chapter 16 and verse 19, who did they seize? Paul, Silas, Timothy, and Luke? No, they just seized Paul and Silas. Now stop and think about that a minute. Luke was a Gentile. Timothy was only half Jewish. His dad was a Gentile. Who did they seize? They seized the Jews. So possibly another display of anti-Semitism there. Back to chapter 18, and this is a very clear display of anti-Semitism. In verse 17 it says, and they all took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. But Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. So the crowd took advantage of this snub that Gallio had given to the Jewish leaders, and they grabbed one of them, Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue. Apparently he had just come into the job. Remember, Crispus was the leader of the synagogue, and he became a believer. So here's Sosthenes, who was the new leader of the synagogue, trying to get Paul arrested and shut down, basically. And the crowd grabs him and beats him up. Now, you're probably asking yourself, is this the same Sosthenes of 1 Corinthians chapter 1? And I have a very definitive answer. I don't know. And I don't think anyone else does either. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. If it is, he became a believer somewhere in between the time he was head of the synagogue here and got beat up and the time that 1 Corinthians was written. So we don't really know if it's the same Sosthenes or not. It was not an uncommon name. Anyway, they beat him right in front of Gallio. And what did Gallio do? He just, okay, you guys are Jews, you're all Jews, fighting among yourselves, go ahead. And even the people who weren't Jews, who were beating up on the Jews, he said it was of no interest to him. So the result of all of this is that Paul is allowed to continue to proclaim the gospel. And this is going to last for a while, not forever. Remember when Nero came into power, and he married a Jewish woman, and things started getting bad for the Christians, and then persecution began. But for now, anyway, Paul is allowed to proclaim the gospel because the Roman official, Gallio, he didn't want anything to do with it. He thought it was just a dispute among these Jewish folks. So Paul stays there, and now we're going to have another section with the gospel going to Ephesus, and in this section we'll have the conclusion of the second missionary journey. And what this section does is it's kind of a parenthesis or an interlude, if you want to call it that, between the second and third missionary journeys. And in this interlude, Paul or Luke, the author of the book of Acts, is going to introduce to us the ministry of Apollos down in Ephesus. So in Acts chapter 18, verse 18 through 28, Paul is going to leave Corinth, and then he'll make two short stops, first at Ephesus, that's in 18 through 21, and then to Jerusalem and Antioch in 18:22. And then 18:23, through 1920 centers on Ephesus, and there will be two parts to that. First, in verse 23 down through the end of the chapter, we'll have the ministry of Apollos, and then in chapter 19, we'll talk about the ministry of Paul again in Ephesus. So first, Paul's return to Antioch in verse 18 through 22. That'll break down into his visit to Ephesus in 18 through 21, and then Jerusalem in verse 22, and then back to Antioch again. So let's read that section now. It'll be the next paragraph plus one more verse, verse 22. So verse 18 says, Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria. And with him were Priscilla and Aquila. In Cenchrea he had his hair cut, for he was keeping a vow. They came to Ephesus, and he left them there. Now he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to stay for a longer time, he did not consent, but taking leave of them and saying, I will return to you again if God wills, he set sail from Ephesus. When he had landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church and went down to Antioch. And of course, Antioch is where he started out from. So that ends the second missionary journey. So he has a visit to Ephesus, a visit to Jerusalem, then back to Antioch. So the evangelization of Ephesus then covers verse 23 down through 19:20. And again, first part, the ministry of Apollos, and then the second part, the ministry of Paul in 19:1 through 20. Look at verse 23. It introduces the third missionary journey, but then Luke goes back to talk about Apollos. Verse 23 says, and having spent some time there, that is Antioch, as he finished the second journey, he left and passed successively through the Galatian region and Phrygia, strengthening all the disciples. So that's the third journey that will be, it's just noted here. He doesn't say much about it, and we'll get to that. So that's where we're headed. Let's look at Paul's visit to Ephesus then in verse 18 through 21. First thing we want to look at is his vow that he made before leaving, and that's in verse 18. Verse 18 says, Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria. With him were Priscilla and Aquila. In Cenchrea, he had his hair cut, for he was keeping a vow. Now, what does that mean? He had his hair cut because he was keeping a vow. This refers to, most probably, the thing that fits best anyway, would be what is called a Nazarite vow. And if you want to read about Nazarite vows, look at Numbers chapter 6, verse 1 through 21. I'll just say a few things about a Nazarite vow, but you can read about it at your leisure. Numbers 6, 1 through 21. Some things to remember about a Nazarite vow. The first one is important. It was completely voluntary. This wasn't a law that God said you have to do a Nazarite vow. It was voluntary. When somebody wanted to voluntarily, and often it had to do with thanking God for something in particular, they would take a Nazarite vow and they would do certain things, and those things are talked about in Numbers chapter 6. The vow was for a set period of time. And what they would do would say, I take this vow, this Nazarite vow, for this period of time, I won't. It had things like you can't drink wine, you can't touch a dead body, you have to remain clean, that's ceremonially clean, that sort of thing. So that's what this vow involved, and it was done often for Thanksgiving. And during this vow, during this set period of time, you couldn't cut your hair. So that your hair had to remain uncut. It was kind of a symbol of the vow. So when you got your hair cut, it meant the vow was terminated. It was done. You had fulfilled your set period of time for the vow that you had taken voluntarily to thank God for one thing or another. Now, when they cut their hair, what they did was they delivered it to the temple in Jerusalem. They'd take their actual hair, deliver it to the temple in Jerusalem, and then burn it as an offering. So that's how the vow went. It's called a Nazarite vow. Now the question is, why did Paul take a Nazarite vow? That's a very Jewish thing to do. I mean, was he a legalist? Was that it? Was it something he shouldn't have done? And there are three major viewpoints as to why Paul took a Nazarite vow. Since the vow terminated in Caesarea, and remember Caesarea was the seaport town for Corinth, when people took their goods to Corinth, they'd take them across to Caesarea. So he's leaving Corinth. So his vow terminated as he was leaving Corinth. So possibly, and some people say this, and it's a good explanation, is that it was a vow of thanksgiving for the protection he received in Corinth. Look back at chapter 18, verse 9 and 10. Remember when God was encouraging Paul? He said, "And the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, 'Do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in the city.'" So Paul may have taken a vow, a Nazarite vow, as a way of thanking God. And it would be a very Jewish way of thanking God. And of course, Paul was a Jew. So since it was completely voluntary, it was not a legalistic thing to do. It was just a thanksgiving thing. Paul said, "Thanks, God. I'll take a Nazarite vow." And as he was leaving Corinth, where the protection was taking place, he had his hair cut because that terminated the vow. And then, of course, he was heading for Jerusalem, so he would take his hair along with him to burn it at the temple. That's one viewpoint. Another viewpoint is that it might have been something he did to placate the Jews in Corinth. Paul was not opposed to placating the Jews if it would further the gospel. Remember Acts chapter 16. We just read those. Look back at Acts 16, 1 to 3. Talk about doing something and going out of your way to placate the Jews. In chapter 16, it says, "Paul came also to Derbe and Lystra, and a disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek. And he was well spoken of by the brethren who were in Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted this man to go with him, and he took him and circumcised him. And why did he do it? Because of the Jews who were in those parts, for they all knew that his father was a Greek." So Paul had Timothy circumcised to placate the Jews. Was he a legalist? No, he was just trying to further the gospel. He knew it. Circumcision had nothing to do with salvation, but he did that so that Timothy would have access to the synagogues. So he would placate to further the gospel, never at the expense of truth. Remember in Acts chapter 15, Paul had adamantly refused to let Titus be circumcised. Why? Because there was an issue at stake. The issue of, is circumcision necessary for salvation? So in that case, when truth was at stake, Paul said, "No way, not a chance, never have Titus circumcised." But now he takes Timothy, just the next chapter over, and he says, "Okay, I'll have Timothy circumcised so he can be more effective to the Jews." You see the difference? And Paul was not averse to placating the Jews. And possibly he took this Nazarite vow as a way to placate them. Verse 6 of chapter 18 kind of argues against this interpretation. Remember in verse 6, and we're talking about the Jews, it says, "But when they resisted and blasphemed, he shook out his garments and said to them, 'Your blood be on your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles.'" doesn't sound like he's placating there. He's just saying, I give up with you guys. Now, that doesn't completely rule out the interpretation, but it kind of argues against it. Third view is that Paul just made a mistake. He slipped into legalism for a bit. There's not much support for this view. I mean, there's really nothing in the text that would indicate that. I know the correct view. The correct view is we can't be sure. We don't know exactly why Paul took a Nazarite vow. I mean, we can have all these theories, and they're very good, very possible explanations of what it's talking about, but we simply don't know for sure. Now, that brings up and I've talked about this before, so we'll just go over it briefly, the three classes of interpretation of a passage. When you come across a passage like this that seems somewhat unclear, there are three ways to classify passages, and you fall back on this. First one is absolute. And we looked at an absolute interpretation last Sunday when we looked at the resurrection in John chapter 20. There's absolutely, unequivocally, no other way to take John chapter 20 than Jesus Christ literally, physically, in space and time, after he was dead, got up out of the grave. There's just no way to get around that. It's an absolute interpretation. There are no different viewpoints unless it's a liberal, well, the Bible is wrong viewpoint. There's just no getting around it. It was a physical, literal resurrection. That's an absolute interpretation. That's the first class. Now, some interpretations are what we call probable. This is probably what happened. Genesis chapter 4, verse 16 is an example of that. Look at Genesis 4 and verse 16. Verse 16 says, "Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain had relations with his wife, and she conceived." Now, there's a problem with that passage. Can you see what it is? Remember, Cain and Abel were the sons of Adam and Eve. Where do you get a wife? That's the problem with that passage. And I have a probable explanation. He married his sister. And we get all shocked about that, but I'm told, and I'm not an expert in genetics by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm told that their genetic material was so diverse, being the first people, that inbreeding was not a problem with them. As people separated and inbred, then inbreeding became a problem, and recessive genes became a problem. But for them, it was no problem at all. So where did Cain get his wife? Well, he married his sister. That's a probable explanation. Nothing else really makes a lot of sense. Now, the third classification of interpretations is possible. And that's what we have here in front of us. I've given you several different options that are all quite possible. They're all good explanations. And the fact is, we just don't know for sure. Does it make any difference theologically? No, doesn't. But those are the classes of interpretation. And here we have a possible. So did Paul do this to conciliate the Jews? Quite possibly. Did he do it as a vow of thanksgiving to God in his own Jewish way that he was accustomed to? Quite possibly. I don't think Paul did it as a legalistic thing. I don't believe that interpretation. But, you know, there's our possible interpretations. Okay, let's move on now. The journey down to Ephesus. Now, Paul's going to go now from Centuria. Here's Corinth again, and Centuria, just across the isthmus, about 5 miles, and head on over to Ephesus, almost directly across the Aegean Sea. So he's heading over to Ephesus. Ephesus, again, very well situated for east-west travel, because Where did the boats go? They went to Corinth, Centuria, and then straight across you have Ephesus. So it's another very major location. It was the greatest commercial city in Asia Minor, and that would be this chunk over here in Asia Minor. It was a free Greek city. It had its own senate, very prominent city now in Ephesus. The religious significance of Ephesus is, then this is an artist's interpretation or an artist's idea of what the temple would be. It was the site of the temple of Artemis, the temple of Artemis. Artemis was the mother goddess. The Romans called her Diana. Artemis or Diana. This temple was one of the seven wonders of the world. It was made out of marble. It had 127, by some counts, and you get different counts, but some counts put these columns at 127 of them, 60 feet high each. So it was more than twice the size of the Parthenon in Athens. Remember when we looked at Athens, we looked at the Parthenon? This thing was twice as big as that. So it's a huge temple. The foundation was approximately 200 by 400 feet. So we're talking a big place here. Now, that's going to play into Paul's coming to Ephesus, because shrines to Artemis were made in Ephesus. And it was a very, very lucrative business, because this was the center of the Artemis or Diana worship. So here comes Paul into this town that made its living off this temple and subsidiary activities, shrines and whatnot. Here comes Paul saying, that's a bunch of nonsense. You know, that's not God. I'll tell you about God. So here comes Paul. He also almost gets killed there because of his message by the citizens of Ephesus. Because they're, again, they feel it in their pocketbook. They're selling shrines to this goddess. And here comes a guy who says that their goddess isn't any goddess at all. So it will play into the picture. Now, in verse 18 through 21, we see Paul's stay down in Ephesus. And we just read that. Remember, Priscilla and Aquila stay behind. Verse 19, it says, they came to Ephesus and he left them there. That's Priscilla and Aquila. Now he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to stay for a longer time, he did not consent. So he just stayed for a little bit. He left Priscilla and Aquila behind. Remember, Paul met these guys when he first came to Corinth. They came from Rome because of Claudius's edict expelling the Jews from Rome. And at some point, they returned to Rome, because in Romans 16, look at Romans 16:3. Paul writes his letter to the Romans. He says, greet Prisca and Aquila. And Prisca is a shortened form of the Priscilla. So it's these same two guys, my fellow workers in Christ Jesus. So he wrote to Rome and said, greet these guys. So apparently they went back to Rome at some point in time. So they went down to Corinth because they got kicked out of Rome by Claudius. And sometime they return. Claudius died in 54 AD. That might have been the thing that made it okay for them to go back to Rome when he died. So they were probably in Ephesus for about 3 years. Don't know for sure, but we do know they were back in Rome when Paul wrote Romans. And we know that Claudius died in 54. So put those things together. Now he goes over to Antioch in verse 22 and 23. It says, when he landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church, that would be in Jerusalem, and went down to Antioch. Having spent some time there, again, he starts the third missionary journey, he left and passed successively through the Galatian region and Phrygia, strengthening all the disciples. So we have the conclusion of the second journey, the beginning of the third journey. Now, next time, Paul is gone from Ephesus And he's going to come back. We'll see that in chapter 19. But while he's gone, Luke is going to talk about the ministry of Apollos down in Ephesus. And that'll be 24 through the end of chapter 18. And we'll pick up there next week. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for this inspired history you've given us in the book of Acts. In Christ's name, amen.